Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Tamfield Talks podcast. Once again, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Piers Harrison, Daniel Dover and Jonathan Upton. We've got lots to talk about in this episode. The Court of Appeal has now handed down judgment in Arkin and Marshall. More on that a bit later on. Also, the Supreme Court has handed down judgment in Duval and 11-13 Randolph Crescent Limited. What was it all about and how will it affect landlords and tenants? And finally, in this episode, we're going to discuss the ideas around space furlough and insolvency protection. Can the government provide more support for businesses facing huge claims from creditors? What is space furlough? Piers Harrison will explain. Well, let's turn first to the case of Arkin and Marshall, in which the Court of Appeal has recently handed down its judgment. This appeal was all about Practice Direction 51Z, the stay on all Part 55 possession proceedings, subject to some limited exceptions brought into force by the amendment. We spoke about this last time on our podcast, so please have a listen again for the background to the Practice Direction. But this appeal concerned three principal issues. One, was the practice direction made ultra vires? Was it a pilot within the meaning of CPR 51.2? Could you lift the stay on a case-by-case basis? Or did the practice direction prohibit any lifting of the stay as the judge found at first instance? And then thirdly, what happens if the parties agree case management directions under paragraph 2AC of the amended practice direction? Are those case management directions stayed as soon as they're agreed? Well, the Court of Appeal has decided that, one, it is possible to challenge the vires of the practice direction in private law proceedings without having to issue a claim for judicial review. That's something that the respondents and the Lord Chancellor, who was an interested party, argued against. But the Court of Appeal said that this was an important case and needed an early authoritative decision. Second, Practice Direction 51Z was not ultra vires, and it is a pilot within the meaning of CPR 51.2. Third, the stay imposed by 51Z can in principle be lifted, but only in the most exceptional circumstances. If the parties agree, those practice direction case management directions under PD 51.2AC, those directions are nevertheless automatically stayed for the duration of the practice direction stay. So, let me turn to my co-hosts. What are your thoughts?
Well, it clarifies something that we discussed on the last podcast, doesn't it? Which is what happens if you agree directions. Are they then subject to the stay or not? And the answer appears to be that they are. So presumably the only directions worth agreeing are directions which take effect on the lifting of the stay.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one. We thought that the stay might not apply to directions where you've agreed them, but the Court of Appeal has clarified that, which is very welcome and helpful for parties. But I do wonder, as we discussed last time, whether defendants in possession proceedings are going to be agreeing much at all. So in practice, I'm not sure if it really will have much of an impact. Jonathan?
I don't understand the logic of that. I mean, if the parties can agree directions, then what is the difficulty in the court and approving an order whereby they can get on with those directions before the 90-day period of the stay comes to an end? I mean, I know they made the point that there's nothing stopping the parties from volunteering to cooperate or comply with their own directions before the end of the stay, but I just don't see why the court in those circumstances can't approve an order.
Well, I think isn't really the underlying point that was raised in the Lord Chancellor's letter and then the Court of Appeal have run with, is they're just trying to take the pressure off the courts themselves. It was it's the administration, the practical administration of the courts that they're trying to ease. And that's been given a massive emphasis in this case as to what the underlying rationale is.
Sorry, Dan, yeah.
Well, that, and that this pretty much puts the kibosh on those proceedings. It stops everything happening so that when it's all lifted, then the courts aren't then faced with a deluge of cases.
Well, I think it has the opposite effect. I mean, if it doesn't reduce the administrative burden because the parties can still apply for the court to approve directions that will take effect at the end of the period of the stay. So if they have to do that box work anyway, then what's the problem with them approving an order for directions that the parties think they can comply with, notwithstanding the restrictions before the end of the stay? I just don't get it.
At the end of the directions, you're going to end up with a hearing. So if everyone then completes the directions and are all ready to go because they've all been getting along nicely in the 3 month stay, everyone's going to turn up at the court door and say, right, we'll have a hearing, thank you very much, we're ready to go.
Yeah, well, better that they're in the position to be ready rather than parties not being able to get ready for trial and then having to wait an extra 12 months before they can have a trial.
Well, what do we think about the decision that the stay can be lifted? The Court of Appeal made it absolutely clear that I think I said earlier the most extreme circumstances. They actually said the most exceptional circumstances, and indeed said that they couldn't think of any examples of when the court might agree to lift the stay. Anyone got any thoughts on that?
Well, it was interesting listening to the hearing itself because, it was suggested in the course of the hearing by one of the Court of Appeal judges that was going to be the position, and they were trying to think of a situation where, in fact, the implication of the imposition of the stay was actually going to cause the disease, the virus, to spread, and that was the situation that was posited. So it's a very, very narrow window. I mean, I think that was really the only issue that was going to, and that's the practical point to take away, is whether they were going to say that each case could be considered on its own merits, whether you lift the stay. And it seemed as if there was some traction there to say, well, parties would only really put that forward if they thought they had some good reason for doing it. But they pretty much shut the door on that one, I think.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that the time where landowners might find that they meet with some of the court's sympathy is if there are occupiers in properties that are causing serious damage to that property or indeed risk to life by their occupation, and they don't come within one of the exceptions in the amended practice direction for whatever reason. Perhaps you know who they are, so you can't say that their person's unknown. But I think that the types of cases that will be amenable to a lifting of the stay will be those ones.
Yeah, I found it a little surprising that the Court of Appeal seemed to be saying that if there are particular circumstances that affect a group of people, then the more appropriate way to try and seek amendment is by writing to the Master of the Rolls, asking him to amend the practice direction, rather than making an application to the court to ask a judge to look at it. I find that very surprising.
I think what the court was getting at there was that applies to interest groups. So as the Property Bar Association and the Property Litigation Association did, they wrote to the Master of the Rolls on behalf of their members. The Court of Appeal aren't, in my view, envisaging individual litigants writing to the Master of the Rolls.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like petitioning Parliament in individual cases to have the law amended.
Yeah.
Your circumstances. It's a sledgehammer to crack a walnut.
I totally get that, but I just thought it was a strange comment, I thought it would be generally more appropriate for any application to be made to a judge rather than writing to the Master of the Rolls to amend the practice direction.
Well, those are all really interesting observations on the Court of Appeal's decision in Arkin and Marshall. If you would like a more in-depth analysis of the case, please do visit the Tamfield Chambers website where there is a fuller case summary. So let's move on and discuss another of the big cases that came out of the courts this week, Duval and 11-13 Randolph Crescent Limited. The Supreme Court handed down its decision last week. Jonathan, Do you want to tell us all about this case?
Yeah, sure. So 11 to 13 Randolph Crescent is a block of flats. The leases are in substantially the same form. I think it's useful to read out the relevant covenants at the outset. There are only three. There are two tenants' covenants which are relevant. Clause 2.6 concerns alterations, improvements, and additions, and that is a qualified covenant not to make alterations, improvements, and additions without the landlord's consent. And of course, Section 19.2 of the 1927 Act applies to that, so the landlord can't withhold consent unreasonably. The other tenant covenant is 2.7, which is headed waste, and that reads not to commit or permit or suffer any waste, spoil, or destruction in or upon the demised premises, nor cut, maim, injure, or suffer to be cut, maimed, or injured any, let's say, structural part of the building. Then the all-important landlord's covenant is in clause 3.19. That's in two parts. And that is the first part is that the landlord shall grant leases in the same form. And the second part reads, and at the request of the tenant and subject to payment by the tenant of and provision beforehand of security for the cost of the landlord on an indemnity basis to enforce any covenants entered into by the landlord. And those covenants would include clauses 2.6 and 2.7. Now, in this case, one of the tenants, Mrs. Winfield, applied to the landlord for consent to carry out some structural works. What she wanted to do was move or remove a significant part of a load-bearing wall at basement level of the building. The landlord undernarred about it, was minded to grant consent, but before it did so, another tenant in the block, Dr. Duval, asked the landlord to secure an undertaking from Mrs. Winfield that she wouldn't carry out those works. Dr. Duval agreed to provide the security for any legal action that was necessary, and then promptly issued a claim in court for a declaration, amongst other things, that if the landlord licensed the works, then that would be a breach of clause 3.19. It got to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal held that there was an implied term which prevented the landlord from granting the license, and the Court of Appeal therefore made the declaration that Dr. Duval was seeking. Piers, do you want to take this on? What happened in the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court upheld the Court of Appeal on the existence of an implied term. The part of the judgment I found most interesting doesn't turn on that. There's a point that Lord Kitchen made towards the start of his judgment that the common approach of the parties, it was accepted by the Court of Appeal, was that Clause 2.7 sets the boundaries of Clause 2.6. So Clause 2.7 governs Clause 2.6. Now, just to remind you, Clause 2.6 is the alterations and improvements clause, and 2.7 is cutting into walls and maiming them, and also governs cutting into wires. And he gave the example of, well, take routine rewiring of a flat. That would fall within 2.6 and within 2.7. So which clause governs the other? And his interpretation was that in the case of routine alterations and improvements, they'd be governed by clause 2.6, which crucially is the qualified clause, and they'd fall outside 2.7, whereas the parties had proceeded on the basis that anything that involved cutting into walls or cutting wires, anything within the express wording of 2.7 was subject to the absolute covenant. And that's why the tenant seeking to do the works would need to obtain a variation of the lease rather than just consent under clause 2.6.
So, Daniel, do you think there's any wider application to this case for landlords and tenants?
Well, there's a couple of interesting things to draw out of it. Firstly, of course, this would apply not just to alterations, but where there's absolute obligations in relation to, for example, alienation or use of the premises. You can have similar conflicts where this decision gives great power then to the other leaseholders in these circumstances. There's also an interesting discussion of when you imply a term. So following on from the Marks and Spencer's case, there's a neat summary of the process of contractual interpretation at paragraph 51, which is useful for the practitioner to go through when you're trying to ascertain when you can imply a term into any contract, but also a lease.
Well, do you think that the Supreme Court was right and that the parties and the Court of Appeal were wrong in that clause 2.7 governs clause 2.6? Because it's not uncommon to see that kind of arrangement of covenants. In fact, Lord Kitchen referred back to the well-known case of Woolworths against Lambert, where there were identical or very similar covenants. And the Court of Appeal in that case said, well, the qualified covenant rules the absolute covenant. And did the landlord miss a trick by accepting that the works fell within the absolute covenant? Should he not have tried to argue, well, these are improvements to the tenant's flat and fall within clause 2.6?
But isn't the key, the final paragraph of the, well, the penultimate paragraph, is where he says it's the non-routine repairs.
He applies a substantiality test.
Yes. So it's only there when you're, so you can cut into a wall, but as long as it's a routine cutting. But if it's more substantial...
But do you find a substantiality test in the wording of the clauses?
No, you don't, because they're more defined in their parameters. But what's clearly happening here, and it's reflected in the analysis of long lease terms, what people can anticipate over the course of the life of the lease, is that big alterations where you're shifting around matters, you're opening up great areas, you're digging into the basement as here, which have structural impacts...
It's definitely arguable the other way, though, isn't it?
You mean that 2.7 is governed by, or is not trumped?
No, I accept that. But Lord Kitchen introduced this substantiality test, and the parties had agreed that it fell or was governed by clause 2.7.
Well, yes.
The substantiality test isn't in the wording, and you could say, well, anything that's in the nature of an improvement is governed by clause 2.6, which uses word improvement.
But that's the point you were making, isn't it? That once the landlord had effectively accepted it fell within 2.7, the game was over.
Well, yes, but then Kitchen says you were right to do that. And all I'm saying is, well, it seems to me that actually there was something to argue about.
So
that.
Do we think that the case substantially shifts the balance of power between tenants and landlord? And do we think it might have any other implications, perhaps, for rooftop developments?
Well, I think certainly leaseholders are still going to have to pause because they're going to have to indemnify the landlord in these cases if they want the landlord to take action. But it will certainly give leaseholders who want to stop another leaseholder from taking action. It'll give them encouragement.
It shouldn't have much effect on rooftop development. I think you mentioned that if... it's the landlord that wants to do the development. It would only be an issue if the landlord was proposing to grant a lease of the roof and the airspace, which was on different terms or which was on the same terms, including 2.6 and 2.7, and then granted the lessee a license to carry out the necessary works.
Yes, in most cases, the landlord wouldn't have to grant some sort of development roof space lease in a manner that would trigger this, that we would do it, and there's no obligation usually for it to do that.
If the landlord wanted to do the works himself, it's not a problem. It might be problematic granting a development lease.
Well, that's really interesting. That's Duval and 11 to 13 Randolph Crescent, the Supreme Court's decision handed down last week. We now turn to space furlough and the insolvency landscape caused by the current pandemic. So let's start looking, first of all, what is space furlough? Piers, tell us a bit more about it.
I'll tell you as much as I know, which is not very much, so it shouldn't take long. But it's been reported in the Daily Telegraph that the government is seriously considering a scheme whereby furloughed shops and restaurants, i.e. those which have been made to close in the recession, receive compensation for the government. And it's been mentioned that the Danish scheme could be a model. So I looked at the Danish scheme, which covers a whole range of fixed costs for companies. And basically, the compensation kicks in once the company in question has suffered a decline of 40% or more in turnover. And you get more compensation the greater the loss of your turnover. So if the scheme is based on that at all, the landlords would get more compensation the less rent they receive. But as of now, we don't even know whether the scheme will be implemented or if it will work on that basis.
No, it's an idea at the moment, isn't it? And I wonder whether when we see in the press that the employee furlough scheme has cost the Treasury much more than it thought it would, whether these ideas for those in the hospitality industry will see the light of day.
Yeah, I mean, given the Prime Minister's statement on Sunday encouraging as many people back to work who could work, I think it's unlikely that they want to spend any more money on a project like this.
Well, there's no doubt that some of these companies do need some support. I mean, just to give you a personal example, I like I'm sure many of our listeners had holidays booked for this year, and in fact I'm meant to be sunning myself in Mallorca this coming Friday, but that's not going to happen. And of course, let's bring it back to the context of England and Wales, but there are plenty of landlords and owners of holiday lets out there who will have cancelled bookings all over, and they will be faced with claims from those who are entitled to refunds. And the reality is those companies just don't have any money. So if they've got
As you found out, Michael, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's I think, the principal reason why the company in question can't refund their holiday makers. It's because they don't have the cash available. And until they secure that cash, they can't offer a refund. And I wonder whether we're just creating a run on these companies in the same way it would be a run on the bank if everyone tries to withdraw their money at the same time and it causes the bank to collapse. Should the government step in and say, well, we're going to give breathing space to these companies? They've got 6 months worth of protection from certain classes of creditors, perhaps consumers, but not, I don't know, suppliers who will also rely on the money to stay afloat. What does everyone think?
How do you do that then? By saying that no enforcement action can be taken for a period of 6 months,
the debt exists, you know, the money's owed, but you can't enforce your right to a refund until later down the line. I'm sure that lots of people want to help these companies, but of course if they get a refund now, they get their money back, whereas if they try and support them with some confidence, the company might not be there in 6 months. So it's perhaps for the government now to offer that protection. Daniel, you've got a few short updates for us, haven't you, on what the government's thinking about generally for legislation?
On a related matter then, and this probably doesn't give an indication that not a lot's probably going to happen. On the 23rd of April, the government announced further measures to protect the high street from what they called aggressive rent collection. And there were three effective measures that they had trailed. The first was to void winding up petitions, second to void statutory demands, and the third was to change the commercial rent arrears recovery regime to give tenants longer time to pay. Of those three, only the last has been affected, so that tenants have 90 days, they have to have 90 days rent outstanding rather than 7 days. So that's a quarter's rent. And that's been brought into effect from the 25th of April. in relation to the other two, the voiding or the temporary voiding of winding up petitions and statutory demands, and they're to be included on the corporate insolvency and governance bill. But 2 weeks later, there's no sign of that happening. So that gives you an indication about the pace at which these changes are happening.
Yeah, I had to look a couple of days ago. I couldn't even see a draft bill on the Parliament site.
Well, all things to look out for. I think we'll leave it there. Lots of things to think about from today's podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. So please do join us again next time. It's just left to say thank you to my co-hosts, Jonathan Upton, Daniel Dover, and Piers Harrison.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.